The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Karen Heller, a national features writer at the Washington Post and a recovering columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Thank you. All of us, if we're lucky, get to work at least once for an inspiring, indelible leader who urges us to do our best, to do better, bolder work than we believe capable of producing, and who creates an environment of sustained excellence. I've been fortunate enough to work for two such editors, the Inquirer's Gene Roberts, a man called legendary so often that it might as well be his prefix, and our guest this evening, Marty Baron, author of the compelling, insightful, and essential new book, Collision of Power, Trump, Bezos, and the Washington Post. Marty hired me at the Post, my first newspaper love as a child of Washington, and changed my life. Prior to the Post, Marty ran the newsrooms of the Miami Herald and the Boston Globe. At the latter, he oversaw the investigation of the Boston Archdiocese cover-up of sexual abuse by Catholic priests, a seismic work of journalism that ignited similar investigations into church cover-ups across the nation. Marty is that rare journalist who is an amasser of Pulitzers as well as Hollywood gold hardware. The Globe's reporting was the basis of Spotlight, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture. In the movie, Marty is portrayed by the considerably taller Liev Schreiber, who also narrates Collision of Power's audiobook. By his own admission, Marty possesses a trimmed gray beard, woolly head of hair, and what was invariably described as my dour and taciturn demeanor. Friends and fellow readers, I have seen Marty smile. I have evidence here of Marty smiling. And I have witnessed him cracking a joke, or rather a semblance of one. During his 8 years shepherding the Post, working for one of the world's richest men, Marty dealt with numerous challenges, including a rapidly changing media landscape, covering Russia's meddling in the 2016 election, the Trump presidency and its elastic relationship with the truth, and an escalating assault on journalism led by the president and his most ardent admirers. By the end of the Trump presidency, the Post's tireless and exhausted fact-checker team had uncovered, wait for it, 30,573 lies and deceptions. During Marty's tenure at the Post from 2013 to early 2021, the Post garnered 10 Pulitzer Prizes, helped restore its Ben Bradley, Katharine Graham era luster, and deployed the news organization's Batman-worthy slogan, "Democracy Dies in Darkness." Marty's book offers insights into all of these and more, including an awkward and memorable White House dinner with the Trumps, which I believe would make a great movie, dealing with the controversial Steele dossier and the challenges of doing great work in a constantly evolving digital world, including the ongoing clash of social media and traditional journalism. Joining Marty in conversation this evening is another stellar journalist, David Boardman, Dean of Temple's Klein College of Media and Communication, former executive editor of the Seattle Times, and founding board chair of the Lenfest Institute for Journalism, the nonprofit that oversees the Inquirer. Please give a hearty welcome to Marty and David. Thank you.
All right, I didn't know whether anybody would show up tonight after last night's show by Bryce Harper, so thank you, and if you do sneak out early, I'll understand. First, let me say, read the book. If you care about journalism, if you care about democracy, I mean, it really is compelling, insightful, enlightening, provocative. Let me also say, This is one of the very few people in the world who could drag me away from a Phillies game. Marty and I were friends and contemporaries when he was the editor of the Boston Globe and I was the editor of the Seattle Times, and I've long admired him. In fact, I can really say without equivocation that he was a giant among us in this fraternity sorority of newspaper editors, one of the most respected journalists in our profession. And we were honored to have him a few years ago speak as our graduation speaker at the Klein College at Temple, and he inspired our grads certainly with his remarks. So I'm going to start with some questions for Marty, and then we'll leave some time at the back of the hour for you all to do the same. So Marty, among the editors and top news executives who were in our little circle, you've always been one to avoid the limelight compared to a lot of our pals, and a much more private person than many of us. So what compelled you to write a book and go on a book tour?
Well, first of all, thank you all for coming, especially tonight with the Phillies playing. And thank you, David, for doing this. A great colleague in the profession and a really tremendous journalist. And thank you, Karen. I obviously have some image repair to do, so I'll get to work on that tonight. So, well, look, I mean, to answer the question, I mean, I lived through an important moment in history. Important moment in history for the country, important moment in history for the press generally, and for the Post in particular. I went to work for a paper that was owned by the Graham family. They had owned it for 80 years. It was a legendary newspaper. It had helped bring down a previous president, Richard Nixon, of course. And then they sold it on my watch about 7 months after I arrived. Big surprise. And sold it to one of the richest people in the world. And he set out to transform the Post for the digital era, to make it a national and even global institution. And then along comes Donald Trump in the summer of 2015. Candidate unlike any we had ever seen before for the presidency, and who became a president unlike any we had ever seen before. And I thought somebody should tell the story of what was happening there. I mean, we do have this motto or mission statement, as Bezos likes to call it, of democracy dies in darkness. The Post and the press play a very big role in that democracy, and we especially played a big role during the Trump administration. And so I thought this was a story that should be told. I was both a participant and an observer of all that happened. And there was really nobody else who would ever tell that story. And Jeff Bezos wouldn't be writing this book. And our publisher, Fred Ryan, wasn't going to be writing this book. And there was really one person who could or would write this book. And only one person, really, who had access to both what was happening in our newsroom and what was happening on the business side and could tell that story. And so I felt that it was an important story to tell, and I set about doing that.
So I'll admit I alternated between the printed version and the audio version as I was driving into work. And how did you have anything to do with getting Schreiber to be the narrator or not? I know you had
not
a bit
really.
Of a
no, I mean, it was my editor's idea. He broached it with me, and I said, well, I don't really want to prevail on Liev to do this. I mean, it feels very awkward. So just go through normal channels. And that's what they did. So they approached his agent, and then he agreed to do it. He actually told me there was a book launch party in New York. He was there, told me that he doesn't like to do these narrations, but he did it for me, which was really grateful. I was really grateful for that. And so we talked a lot there. And actually, during that conversation, we concluded that he and I are actually the same person. So.
All right. Well, he does a great job. So speaking of movies, and I had the same thought Karen did, that opening scene, you know, that riveting cinematic scene where you're describing this dinner meeting with President Trump and Ivanka and Jared in 2017, tell the audience more about that dinner and what it revealed to you at that point about Trump's approach to the press.
Yeah. Well, our publisher, Fred Ryan, thought that it was a good idea with Trump in the White House, that the dominant newspaper in the nation's capital, that we at the dominant newspaper in the nation's capital should meet with him. And I was very wary of that, particularly if Bezos was going to be coming along. First of all, I thought it would give the impression that Bezos was really involved in our news coverage and the content of our news coverage, and he wasn't going to be. And I knew that Trump would view it a different way, would see Bezos' presence as suggesting that Bezos was involved. Trump is a very transactional person. I knew that he would see his allowing us to have dinner with him would be his gift to us, and we would have to give him something in return. I didn't have any intention of giving him anything in return just for having dinner with him. And so I was very nervous. And also, if the dinner became public, I was concerned that the public would think that Bezos was involved in our news coverage. Anyway, we had this dinner, and they were, you know, gracious and welcoming in a very superficial way at the White House, and a certain kind of charm that's, I would say, inauthentic charm. And Bezos was directly across from Trump. I was to his left. And it was clear he was throughout the whole time, in addition to talking about how he beat the Bush machine and the Clinton machine and how he, you know, all this stuff, this usual stuff that you've heard, and the whole
largest
economy,
inauguration
the whole economy had turned around and all this sort of stuff already, whatever, you know, accomplishments real and mostly imagined at that point. He was criticizing the Post, criticizing the press, but criticizing the Post in particular. We seemed to be number one on his hate list. And every time he would criticize the Post, talking to Jeff Bezos, not talking to me, he would poke me with his left elbow. I was very tempted to, you know, go back in the other direction, but he was the president of the United States, so I decided not to do that. And sure enough, you know, after that dinner, well, Melania was there, our editorial page editor Fred Hyatt was there, our publisher was there, Fred Ryan, and then Jeff Bezos, and Jared Kushner was there, and Trump, of course. So after the dinner, sure enough, my expectations were fulfilled. Trump did expect to get something out of that dinner. He called Bezos at 8 o'clock in the morning, said, well, I don't know if you have anything to do with the news coverage, but I'm sure you do, and said, can't you get the Post to be more fair to me?
And this was the next morning?
The next morning at 8 o'clock in the morning. So Trump didn't directly bring that up during the dinner. We actually had Bezos have an actual line prepared for that, which he then used when Trump called him at 8 o'clock in the morning, and that was, well, I don't have anything to do with it. I don't get involved in the news coverage, and if I did, I would regret it for the rest of my life. And they chatted a little bit more, and then Trump ended the conversation saying, well, if there's anything I can do for you, essentially an invitation for Bezos to ask a favor. Bezos didn't ask for a favor after that, thankfully. Jared Kushner contacted my boss, the publisher, Fred Ryan, and asked whether the coverage would get better for them now that they had dinner. We had had dinner. And the publisher said, well, you know, this is not a dial we turn one way to make it better and the other way to make it worse. And, of course, there shouldn't be any expectations about coverage. But you could see that, I mean, this is exactly what I worried about with this dinner, is that Trump would see this as an opportunity to lean on us and that he would expect something in return for that.
And at one point, he called you directly, right? A very bizarre telephone call. Talk about
yeah,
that.
I mean, it was. I guess this was his entree to calling me. I'd never spoken to him before. I hadn't met him before this dinner. And he then called to complain about a story that was done by two of our White House correspondents, Ashley Parker and Phil Rucker. He called me at 9 o'clock. I had just gotten home from work. And he said, the way they had portrayed him made him look like a child. And then he said the words that I never thought I would ever hear a president of the United States say. He said, I am not a child. which to me struck me as a little childish to say that, actually. So, and then he called me a few days later, I think it was, and he complained about another story by our White House correspondents. And he just talked and talked, and, you know, we talked for a long time, and I was just thinking to myself, I don't know about the President of the United States, but I'm kind of busy. When is he going to wrap this up? And because I got meetings to go to. And so he was just kept talking, and then at some point he said, well, this is Amazon, this is Bezos, they're behind this. And I pushed back, and I said, well, that's not true, and you know it's not true. Because I had heard that throughout the campaign, but to hear that directly was annoying. And I don't think very many people push back on him that way. And he broke out in profanities. And he described us as a hate machine, that the Post was a big fat lie. Hmm. And then, you know, I had to wrap it up. So I said, you know, as usual, I would just say, well, thanks for calling, and I appreciate hearing your perspective. Right. And you got to end the call at some point. So that was it. And that was the last time he spoke to me. But he did see, actually after the dinner, he saw Bezos a couple of days later, and he told Bezos, there was a group of technology executives who were at the White House, and obviously the coverage of the Post hadn't changed at all in the intervening few days, and he told Bezos that it was the dinner was a total waste of time. Right. And in my view,
it was
a waste of time, so...
So as you know, I mean, he didn't stop with attacking Amazon, Washington Post. It was, you know, the failing New York Times and fake news, CNN, and all these pot shots, and it became obviously a major theme of his whole presidency. Do you think any of that narrative did real lasting damage to the press in America?
Oh, yeah, I think it did. A lot of damage. I mean, the press wasn't faring so well before Trump ran for office. Trust in the press has been declining ever since Watergate. So we were in pretty bad odor with the American public even before. But Trump made it a lot worse. Constant attacks by a person who was running for the presidency, constant attacks by somebody who became president, that has to have an impact. And not only that, he used the most vile, demonizing potential and dehumanizing language, actually. So, you know, he called us scum and garbage and the lowest form of humanity, and that was clearly not enough, so he called us the lowest form of life itself. And then when he took office, he called us the enemy of the people, which is the language of autocrats. It's been used by autocrats throughout history, and basically suggesting that we were traitors to the country. And so I think it's impossible for that not to have an impact, and I think we saw the decline, an acceleration in the decline in trust in the media. Because of that.
So what lessons can journalists take from that era into, I mean, he's, if you haven't heard, he's running for president again. You know, what can we do differently this time in terms of covering him?
You know, I mean, it's important to remember, I mean, after Trump's first day, his first full day in office, he actually went to the CIA and spoke to CIA agents standing in front of a wall that was memorial to fallen CIA agents. And what did he choose to talk about? He chose to talk about the media. It's an odd subject for that particular moment and that at that particular spot. But he said, as you know, I'm at war with the media. And I think endeavoring to enlist them in his war against the media. And I was asked a couple of weeks later what my reaction was. And I said that, well, we're not at war with the administration. We're at work. And that went viral, crazy viral. And somebody even made up a T-shirt with that and all that sort of stuff. But it does capture my philosophy about it, and that is that we have a job to do, and that we should just do that job and do it in a professional way. And without performative outrage, without, you know, sort of expressing our opinions or what have you, but doing all the research that's really necessary to hold a government to account, to hold political candidates to account, to hold a president to account. I mean, that's the origin of the First Amendment. You know, people, James Madison, you know, the principal crafter of the First Amendment, talked about freely examining public characters and measures. So I like the free part, I like the examining part, the public characters are the politicians and the government officials and the people who influence them, and the measures are the policies. That was the idea for the First Amendment at the beginning. It's the idea for the press today, and I think that we have a mission to pursue, and that we should be faithful to that mission. I noticed at the National Constitution Center there's actually a new exhibit on the First Amendment, and Donald Trump should pay it a visit, find out what that's all about. He cites the First Amendment all the time for himself, he just doesn't believe in it for others. But the other thing that I think we need to sort of do our work in holding Trump accountable in every way. Particularly right now, I really think we need to take a look at what kind of administration would he have if he were to be back in the White House. And he's been pretty open about a lot of that. And a lot of the language he's using is clearly authoritarian in nature, I mean, by definition. So, you know, he's the only person I know who's talked about actually suspending the Constitution of the country. He talks about using the military to suppress legitimate protests. He's talked about bringing treason charges against the outgoing chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and suggesting that he should be executed. He's talked about bringing treason charges against NBC because its coverage is not favorable to him. And all of that, by definition, is authoritarian. And I think, and we really need to take a look at who does he plan to put in cabinet positions? Who does he plan to put in charge of regulatory agencies? What are the policies that he plans to implement on day one? And the reality is, and there have been some stories about this, but not enough in my view, and that is, what exactly are they planning to do? Right. And they are formulating plans because they do think they have a good chance of being elected, and they do plan to run a second Trump administration differently from the way they did the first one. In the first one, he assembled his cabinet based on primarily how people looked, you know, like Rex Tillerson looked like a Secretary of State, therefore he should be Secretary of State. And that's kind of how, and they didn't have any common ideology or even agree on anything, and Trump clearly hadn't really thought very deeply about policies. But since then he has, I mean, not deeply, but he has he has people who have proposals of what they would do, and he clearly has plans to implement that right from the start. So we should look at that.
So one of the biggest revelations and surprises in the book was, as you described this tension within your newsroom over the Steele dossier, which I assume everybody knows this collection of unverified allegations and intelligence reports on Trump and Russia that was put together by a British intelligence agent. As you explain it, your politics reporters were pushing hard to verify the information, and your national security reporters, both here and abroad, were highly dubious. And meanwhile, you reveal, and this particularly surprised me, as I'm sure you can understand, that you were left entirely unaware of that whole situation, and you describe yourself as pissed, which I found it to be a particularly apt word given the material in the dossier. So what the heck happened in your newsroom?
What happened there? I don't know. I mean, so yeah, exactly. So there are two parts to the Russia investigation. So the first part is what we know to be true, which is that Russia intervened in this election, that the Trump campaign knew about their intervention, encouraged their intervention, was playing footsie, may not qualify legally as coordination or collusion, but it clearly each side knew what the other wanted done. And actually afterwards, Trump said, no, you wouldn't have any problem with a foreign government intervening again, like maybe Norway, is what he suggested. But so this went on. But then there was the Steele dossier, which made these very salacious charges, which is your pissed reference. This came up at the Democratic National Convention, and I was there only for one day and went back to D.C. And when one of the reporters had received information about this so-called dossier, it's not really a dossier, but this so-called dossier, that it came up at a meeting after I had left. And nobody happened to mention to me that there was this report circulating about Trump having engaged in all these activities and having the Russians having compromat on Donald Trump. And what happened exactly? I don't really know. I mean, so it wasn't until December, I think, if I recall correctly, that I was actually told about this when one of the reporters came into my office and said, I don't know if you know what's going on. And I said, what? And then he told me, and I said, nobody tells me anything. It's like, I think what they were trying to, my guess is first they were just trying to verify before they bring it up, because maybe there's nothing to it. And or maybe there was a big story, and then they would tell me that they had actually verified this incredible information about Donald Trump. And until they did that, there was not much, they didn't really think that they needed to mention it to me. But this must have just gone on. Mm-hmm. The process of trying to verify the Steele dossier went on for months and months. There was huge disagreement on our staff about how seriously it should be taken, how reliable the sourcing was on it, or who even the source was, and a lot of secrecy among members of the staff, people not telling each other what they knew. A lot of arguments, a lot of friction on the staff over the Steele dossier. So they never, I mean, nobody ever chose, I think they just forgot that they hadn't brought it up. And then, you know, and then finally somebody realized that I didn't know anything about.
And was that before or after BuzzFeed published it?
Oh, that was before BuzzFeed published it, yes, because BuzzFeed published it in January of as Trump was about to take office. So that was it. And finally, we sort of organized meetings where everybody got together, sat in the same room, discussed what we knew and what the reporting that needed to be done. But there is still a lot of residual bitterness on the staff over the disagreements that resulted from that investigation.
Another surprise for me in the book was your pretty positive portrayal of Jeff Bezos as somebody who covered him and Amazon from the start as an editor when he was among this group of young Turks in Seattle who were, you know, changing the world, Bill Gates and Ballmer and Howard Schultz. And he was notorious as being the least civic-minded, the least philanthropic, and the least likable. And he comes across as a pretty different character in your book. I was certainly suspicious of his motives when he bought the Post, and you admit that you were too. So, talk about how all that evolved and how you came to respect him, clearly.
Sure. Yeah, well, look, what I write about is my own personal experience with him and his time at the Post. I'm not pronouncing on all the other controversies. Mm-hmm. We covered all of the other controversies involving Amazon. It's labor practices, it's intrusions into people's privacy, it's lobbying in Washington. You know, I don't think that our technology reviewer ever gave a single Amazon product a positive review. I mean, the last one I remember was where he called Amazon creepy, and I never heard a word from Bezos about any of that, and about any of our coverage of him or any subject, as a matter of fact, in terms of trying to get involved in it. I mean, when we were covering his affair and all of that, you know, he didn't intervene at all in our coverage. We could write whatever we want. And he said, actually, at the very beginning, when he had his first town hall meeting with the members of the Post newsroom, he said, he was asked about, you know, how can you actually buy a newspaper? Every time the press calls Amazon for a comment, all you have to say is no comment. Right. That's all you say. And he said, well, you know, you have the right to ask, and Amazon has the right not to answer. And so it's like, you do your job, Amazon will do what it thinks. You do what's right for you, Amazon will do what's right for it. You both have the right to do that, and that's how he views the world. My own experience with him was that he left us alone to do our, he didn't intervene at all in the content of our coverage. I was incredibly grateful for that, particularly given that he and Amazon came under extraordinary pressure from a person who is arguably, easily, the most powerful person on the planet, and the President of the United States. And Trump made great efforts to try to sabotage Amazon in various ways through the raising postal rates, intervening in a giant $10 billion cloud computing contract with the Pentagon, and Bezos never caved, not during the campaign, not afterwards. And that's extraordinary. I mean, I can think of a lot of business people who would have.
Oh,
most
absolutely.
Business people probably would have, and at least the ones I know. So, and I know a lot. So that was really extraordinary. And then on a personal level, you know, he was fun to be around, actually. So I don't know how much time you spent with him personally, but did you?
Enough.
Yeah, enough, okay. But in any event, I mean, if you go to dinner with him, I mean,
I like him now after reading your book.
Yeah, well, there you go.
I didn't.
But I mean, he's very self-deprecating. He has a great sense of humor. He's easy to talk to. He's very curious. He's well-read. When he met with our reporters, which wasn't nearly often enough, but when he would meet with the occasions where he met with Pulitzer Prize winners, for example, he had clearly read their stories, and he asked really good questions about it. He has a, you know, incredibly active mind. You know, so I found, and it, to me it was like, I mean, sitting in a meeting with him, talking about business matters, where I would participate in those meetings, it was like, and I already had an MBA, but this was pretty good MBA program, I got to say. And he was really interesting, and
he
was a fresh thinker. And he had a vision about what we should be. Yeah.
And I will allow a few $1 billion can make a guy a lot nicer, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, when you'd go to dinner, there was one particular dinner at a very, and I mentioned this in the book, and we at a very hip hotel in D.C., and he said to the waiters, he says, well, he doesn't want to make any more decisions, so just wants no stress whatsoever, just bring whatever you want. And as I note, you kind of have to have a certain kind of bank account for that kind of right. stress relief program. Right. So,
you know, given that, I mean, it's clear that you had a real synergy with him about the vision. And as Karen mentioned, I mean, the Post certainly was rejuvenated under his ownership and your leadership. The back third or so of the book I found poignant, you know, touched me deeply as an editor, because you really are revelatory about the struggles that you were going through in terms of your staff, your profession. And in 2020, which was a year I think that probably everybody in this room was doing a lot of self-examination about your life, your career, you certainly were. And you talked about, contemplated an exit that you ultimately didn't take until February of 21. But at the heart of that despondency, you reveal a lot about these two emerging disputes that you were having with members of your staff, particularly a younger generation of journalists, and I want to talk a little bit about those. The first was over the use of social media, and you were troubled that some journalists on your staff were expressing opinions and reposting things on Twitter in a manner that you just thought was inappropriate and threatened the brand of the Post. You know, I want to know more about why you objected to that, and particularly in a context where we're hearing from a lot of media analysts and researchers and scholars that readers and viewers want a more intimate relationship with journalists. They want to know more about them, you know, from behind the curtain, and that it's actually good for journalists to develop a personal brand.
Yeah, sure. Well, they get to know them, you know, to a fair degree. I think we have to go back to some basics here, which is, why do we have editors? Why do we have editing? What does that mean to edit? So what do editors do? You know very well, okay? They organize the journalism and they execute the journalism, and they do that in tandem with reporters. The reporters are assigned to cover certain subjects and certain stories, and they rely on those reporters. They select those reporters based on their experience, their expertise, their judgment, and they go about that reporting according to well-established standards of the institution of a place like the Washington Post or the Seattle Times or the Philadelphia Inquirer, whatever it might be. And when they encounter sensitive circumstances or new circumstances, we talk about it among ourselves, collectively, about what are we going to do. Sometimes they'll talk to the editor, the actual top editor of the newspaper about how do we want to approach this. But we do it collectively as an institution about what's the appropriate way to cover this story. Well, what happens to all that? And we do that because we want to maintain the institutional reputation. And we think it's important because that is our identity. That is what our face to the public. That is who we are. And anybody who joins that institution sort of should understand that they're joining an institution and that they buy into that reputation, and they're there to help support that reputation. Well, what happens when somebody on the staff decides to get involved in a story that they haven't been invited to get involved in? They post on Twitter or some other social media outlet some commentary. They inject themselves into the story. They say something however they want, whenever they want, with total freedom. Well, sometimes those tweets become the focus of the public's attention. They become the representation of what we are as an institution. That decision, impulsive decision in many instances, by one journalist doing their own thing, whenever, however, and whatever they want to do, without any editorial review, without any editorial consultation, what have you. And when that happens, particularly on controversial subjects, it basically undercuts and sabotages the entire effort that we took trying to cover stories collectively, institutionally, with the right reporters, with the right editors, with us doing that, then what happens to all that? They become the face of the post journalism, not all the work that we did as a post, as an institution, becomes incidental to all of that. And so I think if we are to maintain our reputations as an institution, if we are to in fact preserve institutional standards, then there has to be a lot more care and a lot more restraint on the part of journalists in our newsrooms in terms of how they use social media, because a lot of it has been incredibly reckless and very damaging to our reputation, and by the way, even damaging to their colleagues who are trying to cover those subjects, mm-hmm. and the people they're reporting on judge them by a tweet posted by somebody who was not even involved in that story. And many times it makes their life incredibly difficult in terms of doing that reporting.
Another intramural battle that you weighed on you and that you discuss at some length was over a principle that you and I were taught was sacred, objectivity. Your dispute over that principle became quite public as critics inside and outside your newsroom asserted, as they have in many newsrooms, that objectivity is this false god, and that over time it has resulted in journalistically poor coverage of climate change, which is a really great example, I think, and many other issues. And then particularly the debate got heated in the George Floyd summer when many black journalists in particular felt that traditional American journalism had really let the country down. My own thinking about this has evolved quite a bit. I think it's a bit different than yours at this point. But I think, you know, it is undeniable that journalism has fallen short in many regards historically. And why do you hold so dearly to that principle?
Well, I think we need to understand what the principle is, first mm-hmm. of all. And I think that a big problem right now is that people have mischaracterized what objectivity actually means. It's a principle that goes back more than 100 years to, you know, when Walter Lippmann wrote Liberty in the News. And it wasn't false balance. the whole idea of objectivity that Walter Lippmann wrote about was to work against the propaganda of the era, the propaganda that had led the United States into World War I and the slaughter that World War I was, and how the public had been deceived by that propaganda. And so the idea behind objectivity, it's, first of all, let's talk about what it's not, okay? It's not false equivalence. It's not both sidesism. And I'll give you an example of that from my own experience, and that's the coverage of the Catholic Church scandal. So when I got to Boston, the day before I started work, we had a column by Eileen McNamara, a terrific columnist, about a case of a priest who had been accused of abusing as many as 80 kids. And the lawyer for the plaintiffs in that case said that the cardinal himself was aware of the abuse and reassigned that priest from parish to parish without telling anybody, not the public, not the parishioners, nobody. And the archdiocese said that was just not true. Okay, so, and that's where the Globe had left things. That's balance, all right? It was balanced. One side said one thing, one side something else. That balance was the problem, okay? It was the problem. It's not, that balance, by the way, was not objectivity. What objectivity was is what I was looking for when I went to my first meeting on my first day and said, can't we get at the truth here? So can't we get at the truth rather than get beyond one side says one thing and one side says something else? And we did. So we went to court to try to get those documents, all the internal documents of the Catholic Church, the Archdiocese in Boston, and we launched a parallel journalistic investigation to talk to survivors, to talk to lawyers, to talk to priests, to talk to everybody we could, to do what objectivity is, and that is to do a thorough, comprehensive, rigorous job of looking at all of the evidence without letting your own preconceptions and pre-existing opinions getting in the way of that. So we needed to go about that work in Boston without, you know, somebody saying, oh, yeah, well, the church, you know, they have no moral authority. Look at what their position is on abortion. Or, gee, I had a terrible time in Catholic school because the nuns were really mean to me. Or, you know, or something else. Or you know, yeah, it's celibacy. They're all, you know, there's something, you know, strange about all of these priests. You know, none of that. That shouldn't get in the way of our coverage. Nor, by the way, should get in the way of our coverage is that, okay, well, my faith is Catholicism. I don't want to hurt the institution of the Catholic Church. None of that from either side should get in the way. The job of objectivity is do a thorough, comprehensive, rigorous job of looking at all of the evidence, talking to everybody you need to talk to, and then telling the public what we've actually learned. What we have learned, not I believe that being fair means also being fair to the public. And being fair to the public means telling them what was the result of all the work we just did, not pretending that we didn't do that work, okay? So where does the evidence point? And clearly, in that instance, the evidence pointed to not only extensive, you know, widespread abuse by priests, but a cover-up that had lasted almost half a century. So that is objectivity. I think it's been conflated with false equivalence, with neutrality, with balance, all that sort of stuff. And when people say, I don't like the word objectivity, I think they don't actually understand what objectivity really means. So objectivity, in my mind, is how it was originally defined by Walter Lippmann, working against the propaganda of his time. And what it means today is doing that kind of thorough research and telling the public what we really have learned. And that's what I have tried to practice wherever I've been.
My position, which people didn't pay to hear, but is not that far away, but I actually believe we need to be more revelatory about where we're starting and then using, in the same way that you are, and in fact even maybe more aggressively in opening, prosecuting our own ideas and our own biases as in the process to use objective methods. Sure. I think more about objective methods than
objectivity. Objectivity is designed to be in a method. That's the whole idea of objectivity is a method, not a goal. It's a method to get at the truth. People say, oh, no, we should replace objectivity with truth. Truth is not a method.
Right.
Truth is a goal. Objectivity is a method for getting at the goal. Where I have problems is, so for example, now one of the outlets, like Semaphore, in the middle of the story, they say, here's the reporter's view. Well, when I react, look at that, I say, well, what entitles you to a view? You did one story? You have an opinion already based on one story? It's a little early. And it's like, what do I care what your opinion
but
is?
But you're such you a big know? Fan of Ben Smith.
Yeah, well, yeah. But I mean, I'm not a fan of that. I'm certainly not a fan of that concept there, because right. the concept is somehow the reporter is supposed to express an opinion. And my reaction is, on what basis do you have an opinion having reported one story? You're not entitled to an opinion yet.
Right. I've been told I have one more question. I actually had many, but oh. I'll ask one more. I'll make it a three-part question.
I wasn't filibustering you, David, I promise.
So obviously, as you know, and we were talking before this started, the Washington Post is looking quite a bit more precarious than when you departed, with digital subscriptions down dramatically, the announcement of pending job cuts. It's happening all over the country in almost every newspaper, news deserts everywhere, two papers a week closing down. At the Post itself, and I don't want to put you in too awkward a position here relative to your successor, but what do you think's gone wrong? You know, what is the answer for the Post? And then finally, would you consider going back as the publisher?
Well, let me answer the last question first. That's a definitive no. No way. So anyway, I mean, I think the fundamental problem is that the Post didn't prepare adequately for a post-Trump era. So much of our growth was driven by people who really supported the Post because they saw us holding Trump accountable. They had lost faith, and they were concerned that Congress would not hold Trump accountable. They were concerned that the courts wouldn't. They looked at the media, finally not taking us for granted, as so many had done before. And when they looked at the media, they saw two primary institutions, the New York Times and the Washington Post, holding Trump accountable. And we earned their support and their subscriptions from that, and the traffic on our site as a result of that as well. But it became clear to me in 2018, after the Republicans lost the House, that you know Trump might not be there for a long time. And anyway, we needed to prepare for the possibility. He didn't win with a majority of the popular vote. And we needed to prepare for the possibility that he wouldn't be around and that wouldn't be such a driver of our coverage. And you could look at the New York Times, and they had added, you know, the cooking app, and they bought Wirecutter, and they had a games initiative, which it was in a nascent stage at that point, but I was aware of it. And I did urge the publisher to say, we need a strategy for a post-Trump era, because politics has been such a driver of our success. And we did have six straight years of profitability. But sadly, that conversation never happened. I mean, I asked the publisher to bring Bezos in for that discussion. He didn't bring it up with him. And we never had that discussion. And Bezos had a lot of other things on his mind, I'm sure, at the time. At the same time, even after I left, there was just a tremendous amount of expansion. They added just tons of people. And I was surprised at how many people were being added at a time when the digital advertising market was already beginning to weaken, and subscriptions were beginning to show weakness too, because Trump was no longer in office. And all of a sudden, people were willing to take the press for granted again. So the amount of spending was really, I thought, extraordinary, given what the economic environment was. Those factors, I think, the primary ones. There was investment for, you know, some additional investment, but then, you know, the digital advertising market suffered, subscriptions suffered, and they're paying the price for that now. It's not surprising. I mean, they're projected to lose $100 million this year. It's a lot of money. And ostensibly, people on the staff are surprised that there are these cuts. I mean, I don't know, when you see that there are going to be $100 million in losses, something is going to happen. I mean, I think that's basically a sort of a law of business. Nobody, these kinds of losses are not going to go on forever, and certainly Bezos had never had an intention of running the Post as a charity, and I don't think he should run it as a charity, by the way. It needs to be a sustainable business, just like the rest of, like other journalistic institutions. So they got themselves into a bind. They now are trying to get themselves out of it. But I actually am optimistic about the Post. I think they can do it. A lot of people wrote us, you know, I think you have to be careful about projecting from one year's performance into the future. It wasn't that long ago that people talked about the New York Times possibly going bankrupt. They had to go to a Mexican billionaire, Carlos Slim, for a financial rescue package. Their stock went from $50 a share to $350. and people said that it was going to be over, the New York Times would be overtaken by BuzzFeed News and Huffington Post. Well, that didn't happen, all right? And the Post, when I got there, people said it was going to slide into oblivion. It was sliding into oblivion. We had to cut about 35 people in that first year, 50 in this, and I was planning, expecting to have to cut another 50. There were 580 staffers when I got there, and we were cutting, and it was likely that the Post was going to be cutting perpetually. So even after the buyouts that are proposed, or I hope there won't be layoffs, but if they don't get enough buyouts, they say they'll go to layoffs. But after the job cuts, in the newsroom of the Post, I think it's what I saw is there are going to be 940 people in that newsroom. We start when I got there, it was 580 when we cut 35 in the first year. So you're talking about still pretty good growth and a great opportunity to do really good work, and the Post continues to do really excellent work. And so I have confidence that they'll find their way through this.
And I'll take just 30 seconds to put in a little plug for the situation here in Philadelphia. I hope you all realize how absolutely fortunate we are here, mostly on the basis of the vision of Jerry Lindfest to create this nonprofit that owns the Philadelphia Inquirer. The Inquirer is not what it once was in terms of the size of the staff, but it is among the largest local newspaper staffs in America. There are thousands. Annie, where are you? How many people are we up to now in terms of donors? 5,000 individual donors in addition to the gift that Jerry gave. And, you know, it's a pretty damn good newspaper, so I hope you all can appreciate and support that. All right, turning to the audience for questions. There's a mic in the back.
Okay. Mr. Barron, good. Democracy dies in darkness. If you could have come up with a slogan, what would it have been and why?
I spent a whole chapter describing how we came up with that. It was really excruciating. I mean, it took almost 2 years. We had about 1,000 mostly bad options to look at. I was actually wary of that slogan because I think most marketing people would say you shouldn't really have death and darkness in your slogan. But, you know, we thought we had something different, and we worked on it, and Bezos took it back. He flew back to Seattle, and he showed it to his wife, his then-wife, who was a novelist, and he then sent us a note, an email saying, bad news. She called it Franken's slogan. So, and then he said, well, why don't we just use Democracy Dies in Darkness, which is something that Bob Woodward has been saying for a long time, based on a court ruling by U.S. federal judge Damon Keith. There was Democracy Dies Behind Closed Doors. But it was not my preference. My preference was a phrase that had been used by one of our photographers, courageous photographer. He had been covering the crisis of Ebola in Africa, and he wrote a piece and he said, the story must be told. And I thought that was very powerful, and I thought maybe we should use the story must be told. But you know, the truth is that Democracy Dies in Darkness been an amazing success. I mean, it's like everybody can cite it, which is really something. It got mocked pretty severely at the beginning, and Bezos thought, that's great. People noticed, as opposed to most mottos that nobody remembers. So he was thrilled with that. So as long as it worked, a lot of people suggested we get rid of it after Trump left the White House. I said, wait, we don't need that anymore. And no, we do.
So I have a question about what presumably are the multiple causes of the sort of dramatic fall in the journalistic business over the past several decades. Obviously, the business model and the internet have changed things dramatically. The era of Trump and fake news, as you said, certainly didn't help. But I'm wondering about whether there's been another change over time, and that is, to put it bluntly, sort of the dumbing down of your potential audience, that the appreciation of the preciousness of our democracy and what it takes to keep it and to keep it healthy has been declining among younger generations for decades.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if it's exactly younger generations, because if you look at a lot of Trump voters, I mean, they tend to be older. So, I mean, I think Americans have not really understood their democracy for a long period of time. They've taken a lot for granted. They've certainly taken a free and independent press for granted. They don't really understand. There's a real lack of civic education, how government works. People have no idea how you pay for roads and bridges and all things like that. They don't know what it takes. So I think there's a real problem there. You know, and also I think it's important to look back historically in the United States. There's always been a long theme of anti-intellectualism in this country, and also decades and centuries of conspiracy thinking in this country. And right now, if you look at, take any conspiracy, you're basically going to find 25-35% of the country believes it. So whether it's denying the Holocaust or saying it's exaggerated, whether it's that vaccines cause autism, or whether it's whatever happened on 9/11, you know, that they don't accept what actually really did happen, or that it's the 2020 election was illegitimate, stolen, that sort of thing. 25-35% of the country believes any of that. So all of that. You know, I think, so that portion of the population, I think, we're probably not going to reach with facts, but there's still, I think, a substantial portion of the population that is open to facts, open to evidence. And people judged Trump based on his record and what they learned about who he was. Republicans lost in 2018. He lost the White House. And then after that, in a special election in Georgia, the Republicans lost the Senate. You know, people say that, well, the American public isn't receiving this information. I think the evidence is they are receiving the information. And so a lot of the burden, there's clearly a burden on the American public. They make the decision. We in the press don't make the decision, but the burden on the press is to lay out the evidence, to do it with the thorough, rigorous research that I was talking about before, but doing it in an unflinching way, but doing it in a convincing way, showing people that evidence as much as they possibly can.
Hey, Marty, thank you for coming to the city of brotherly love. My name's Kyle. I'm a freelance writer based outside of Trenton. I was wondering what you think the effect that artificial intelligence will have on journalism, because some companies like Gannett are using it to write up high school sports scores, and that's usually a job that a journalist who just got out of J school will do. So what do you think the effect of AI will have on the future of journalism?
Sure. Well, the Washington Post was using AI, I guess, it wasn't generative AI, but basic AI, to produce sports score results, not write whole stories, but write a paragraph. So these are not very complicated stories. You know, it's who won the game and what the score was. So we did that with the Olympics to get results out quickly, that sort of thing. I think the greater challenge is with generative AI, if you have that going out into the ether and trying to basically assemble a story, you're going to end up, at least so far, you're going to end up with stories that have a lot of what they call hallucinations, but I like to call fabrications, and false information. I do think, however, generative AI can be really useful inside a newsroom, and I'll confess I'm consulting with a company right now, so that hopes to help with that. If you just work with the material that's actually within a newsroom already, that's already verified, that your own archives, the facts that you yourself are putting into a story, journalists right now are juggling so many different tasks. They're having to write constant updates to stories. They're having to write headlines that work for search, for social. They're having to write alerts. They're having to do this all while reporting. They're having to do video, audio, you name it. It's a lot. I mean, it's too much. So I do think that these can be, that generative AI can be used in a very constructive way for time management purposes within newsrooms, where it can relieve the burden on a lot of the people on the staff. So if it's used in that constructive way, I think we should use it. And the reality is that, you know, if news organizations are to find a sustainable model, some of it is going to have to be in terms of how do we make ourselves more efficient, more technology proficient, and ultimately, you know, keep costs down.
Thank you. I look forward to reading your book. Regarding false equivalences, that was something that we certainly paid attention to regarding the emails versus Trump's various predator-like behavior. Recently, it seems like it's been alluded to as an issue when Biden's age and missteps get called out with more frequency than Trump's mere 3 years younger age. I was struck in a recent article that in the New Yorker, I think David Remnick wrote, that the extent of Trump's malevolence obscured his incoherence.
Yeah, it's a good line. Good
it's
line.
A great line, right? But in terms of whether the false equivalence issue and the age and fitness is getting sufficient coverage comes to my mind quite frequently as a reader. I'm interested in your thoughts on whether you see the risk.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a legitimate issue. I mean, I think age is an issue for both of them, by the way. So, I mean, look, I'm getting older. Everybody's getting older. There are things that you can do when you're younger that you don't do so well when you're older, and particularly when you're the age of Trump and Biden. And so, and they both show, that it shows in both of them, by the way, I think. You look at how Trump spoke when he was a younger man, it's pretty different. There's a site called Stat that's owned by the owners of the Boston Globe that actually dissected his use of language and how different it is today from the way that he spoke in the past. It's a really interesting story. But I do think it comes up more often with regard to Biden than it does with the Trump. And I think that people should be paying more attention to Trump's own capacities. And a lot of the more recent videos that I've seen raise a lot of questions about that. And I would hope that people would start taking a look at that as well. So I do think that there's been more emphasis on Biden's age than there has been on Trump's, even though they're pretty close in age. And even though, you know, I think the signs of aging are showing in both of them. I'm setting aside the malevolence part. That is truly an issue. The authoritarianism that I spoke about earlier, but the age issues are showing in both of them as well.
All right, please join me in thanking Marty Baron.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.